ARD.
And we had access to around 600-800 adults. And we asked these different adults, who was the best teacher you had and why? And when we analysed all their responses, we found out there was two factors. Firstly, that teacher turned you on to their passion, and or that teacher saw something in you you didn't see in yourself. Now think of it, passion and expectations. That's what we remember of our best teachers.
Die Schule brennt, der Bildungspodcast mit Bob Blume.
What if we finally knew what really works in teaching and what's just well-intentioned but ineffective? John Hattie is the education researcher who answers precisely these questions. The latest version of his study, he analyzed over 2,100 meta-analyses and the results of 130,000 studies involving hundreds of millions of students, making learning visible and measurable. His conclusion, the greatest influence on students' success is not technology, but the teacher, with a clear, focused emphasis on feedback, clarity, and real teacher-student relationships. By the way, on September the 22nd, from 6 to 8 p.m., John Hattie and I will be speaking live on stage at the Harmonie Heilbronn. If you want to be there, you can still get tickets. You'll find them in the links in the show notes. Dear John, I'm so glad you're here today.
It's great to talk to you, Bob, and I'm certainly looking meeting you and others in person very soon.
That's going to be great. John, you're one of the most well-known education researchers in the world. Still, some people may not be familiar with your work. Can you try to explain what you do and how it helps to improve classroom learning?
Yeah, my intrigue, Bob, was trying to understand why everybody I met in education always could tell me exactly what you had to do to answer your question, how to improve. And they all differed. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of amazing, both meeting teachers and academics. And so I came into this thinking, maybe there's a better way. Maybe if we changed asking what makes the difference to what are the relative effects of the various things we do as students. And at the same time in my career, Gene Glass invented this thing called meta-analysis, which is a very simple way of statistically analyzing studies to ask how big is the effect? Is it small, medium, or large? And so I started collecting meta-analyses. It allowed me to ask the question about the relative effects. But the thing that stunned me the most is 95 to 97% of things that we do to students enhances their learning. Mm-hmm. No wonder every teacher, every politician, every parent knows exactly what you have to do. They're all right. But if you raise the bar and say, what are those effects that are above the average compared to below the average? And that's what I've been trying to do for many years, is to create a story about those more critical factors compared to the, obviously they're important, but they're less critical. So that's what I've been trying to do.
We're going to be looking at these factors, but before we do that, is there anything that you are currently working on that you focus on?
Yeah, like all the time I'm trying to get to a deeper and deeper understanding of what makes the difference. And like over the last few years with my colleague from Germany, Klaus Zahra, from Augsburg, we've been looking at the ways in which teachers and educators think. And we're arguing that it's less what they do that matters and more what they think about what they do that matters. And then we've been working on this concept called evaluative thinking. How do people make value statements, value judgments as part of their thinking? And that leads me, Bob, to what I'm working on at the moment and looking at this teacher self-concept. And it's kind of surprised me how there's very, very little research on it. There's a lot on teacher self-efficacy, but very little on the concept of how teachers see themselves as teachers, what are their motivations, what are their beliefs, what are their attributes. So that's the big project I'm working on at the moment.
Okay, you gotta get into that, because usually I mean, this is kind of what they say, for example, in movie courses, show, don't tell, right? You can tell me anything what you think about, but like if you go into action, I will see what you really want to do. Now, you just turn it around, didn't you? How does that work? Why is it more important what they think they do than what they actually do?
Because you can get two teachers doing exactly the same things. They're using the same methods, the same lesson plans, the same resources, and one gets incredible impact. And the other doesn't. So it's not so much what they do. It's how they make those judgments. And like one of the very simple ways of explaining effective teachers is to say they're nosy. Bob, I want to know what you're thinking right now. I want to know what you did. I want to know how you went about the work you're doing. Show me what you're doing. Think aloud. Those teachers that want to get inside you, inside your brain, want to get inside your shoes to understand what it's like to be Bob the student. Those are the teachers that have the biggest impact. Those who sit back and say, Bob, you didn't do enough. It wasn't good enough. Do it again. That more distanced teacher, they're much less effective. And that's kind of a big difference. But that is really coming down to the essence of those teachers that make the difference are the ones that really want to understand what it means to be a learner.
That's interesting.
One of the fascinations is that if you ask a teacher to talk about their concept of what it means to be a teacher and their theory of teaching, they can talk to you for hours. But if you ask them, what is your theory of learning? It's a much more silent conversation, but that's what makes the difference.
Yeah, I totally agree. Actually, in my last book, I argued that we are not focused on learning at all. Teaching and learning most of the time, two things. But what I found quite interesting is two things. That first of all, it kind of connects to the visible learning theory. One might argue that you've already that's the foundation of your thinking, right? Because the teachers who are effective, they really want to know what is going on with their students and how they can enhance it, right? While the others may just say, well, you know, that didn't work out, try again, and then they're not effective.
Yeah, you're so right. And it's kind of interesting that when you look at, you know, teacher education courses, professional development policies, the concept of learning hardly ever comes up. But every student, every day, they want to know, how did you do it? And so they're absolutely intrigued about that. Now, please don't get me wrong, there's an incredible number of great teachers out there who have theories of teaching and theories of learning, but I want more of them.
Actually, I wanted to ask that later, but now that it comes up, I cannot withhold myself from asking it. Why? I mean, you know, we're living in a world where learning is key. Once you're out of school, you have to have the ability to learn, but also kind of the mindset of interest, right? Because if you don't have that, you can outsource it with AI or you know, just, I don't know, get money, but not be really interested in all that. How come we still don't have so many learning experts? I mean, also, you know, having in mind that your theory is, well, the first theory, right? You've made an update, is almost, is it now 15 years old or something like that? How can that be?
Part of the issue is teaching is a very lonely activity. You're usually the only adult in the room. And for many times, it's so much easier for me as a teacher to perform. It's so much easier for Bob, for me to tell you how to do it, to give you background, to give you knowledge. Watch me how I do it, and then you can do it. And In many cases, nothing wrong with that. But what happens if you don't get it the first time, if you're the student? Often that's the last chance you get. And the students, like all of us, no matter what our prior ability, needs 5 to 7 opportunities to learn something before we learn it. If you only get one, you ain't got any chance. And so looking at it from the learner's point of view, they want multiple opportunities to learn. They want the safety that it's okay in this class to not know. I came to school to learn that which I don't know. I have to have that safety in that classroom. I have to know how to seek help from other students, from teachers, And here's the big one, particularly with AI coming around the corner. I need to be able to make quality judgments. Is it good enough? Is it right? Is it wrong? What do I do next? And those are the skills of a learner. Now, if you want to see it in action, watch 4- and 5-year-olds. They're brilliant at it. Mm-hmm. But once we get them into our classrooms, we tell them, no, this is what it means. I want you to come to work, come to school, well-prepared, sit up straight, and watch me teach. And that's the problem from a learner's point of view. Some kids like that. One of the ironies and the conspiracies is kids above average like the teacher talking about the facts because that's the game they're winners at. But a good learner is the one that's curious. They want to know why. How did it happen? And we don't reward that near enough. We often think it's what happens after the students have some knowledge. But getting knowledge can involve curiosity. Like, I think it's really interesting, if you want to see it in action, watch teenage kids play video games. It's okay to fail. They work with others. They know how to seek help. There's lots of opportunities to learn. They live for the feedback, no matter what happens. We can do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to be talking about effectiveness without getting at least shortly into what it really means. You've just said you systematically ranked nearly 200 factors. Was there like any insight that you found, well, for you, the most important, before you did this big meta-analysis, something that you wouldn't have thought about that's so effective? And maybe, on the one hand, something that you thought is totally effective, but is really not.
Yeah, it's a gift that keeps on giving in that respect. And the trouble was when I find something that really is fascinating, that takes me down a particular route, and same as if I find a problem that I don't believe in, it also allows me to ask the why question. Like we did a separate study, but with nothing to do with visible learning, and we had access to around 600-800 adults, and we asked these different adults, who was the best teacher you had and why? And when we analyzed all their responses, we found out there was two factors. Firstly, that teacher turns you on to their passion, and or that teacher saw something in you didn't see in yourself. Now think of it, passion and expectations, that's what we remember of our best teachers. One of the ironies is that in some ways you could argue they're the hardest to measure. On the other, they're the easiest to measure because you see them, you can feel them. And so it's not that hard, Bob, it's passion and expectations. Now, let me tell you the one that bothers me, the one that has a very low effect size, teacher subject matter knowledge.
Interesting, okay.
That's the exact opposite. But it's very low. And it took us about 15 years to work out what was happening there. And it turns out there's an interaction between teacher subject matter knowledge and how you teach. If you teach one page ahead of the students, then subject matter knowledge doesn't matter. But if you teach allowing the students to make errors and have a right proportion of surface and deep, then subject matter knowledge matters a lot. So that was one that took me about 15 years of doing many, many studies and failing many times. But that's what the fun thing is. Like, one of the interesting things is 3 years ago, there was no meta-analysis on AI. Now there are 20. Doubles the effect size of learning. But the fascination is the detail, the moderators, what actually happens as students and we learn to teach them AI. And I worry that we're going to do the same as we did with social media. We're going to see it as something kids do separately and it doesn't change how we teach. And that's another area that I'm finding fascinating at the moment to look at. Why is that effect so high in such limited areas?
You talked about the irony of these two very important, you could almost say, it's between character trait and competence, isn't it? I mean, to be able to really have a spark or to set a spark for something that you yourself like, it has to be something that you're socialized with yourself, right? I have to love reading in order to make student read, but like to open up the space that they actually think, well, maybe this is something I want to do. I would have thought the irony is, in order to become a teacher, this is not being tested. You can become a teacher without these two very important competences, right? Shouldn't the whole system be changed in a way that only the passionate people and the ones who are interested in student progress be able to become teachers in the first place?
Well, just on that, you know, my wife has been running a selection process into universities across Australia, and it's been a recent government initiative a few years ago. One of the things that she found in the first year is about 10 to 15% of the applicants for teacher education don't like students. Now, you think that's a pretty minimal thing, but they'll say, oh, no, I don't want to deal with those kind of students. Now, if you say that, you've never been in a classroom, because every classroom has those kind of students. There's always problematic students. That's the beauty of great teachers. They know what to do with those kids. We had, I think it was 29 people apply who had PhDs. A third of them said on the scale, I don't want to work with kids. Mm. It just doesn't make sense to me. So, and your point is passion. Now, one of the troubles in initial teacher education is there's so much they have to learn that they see it about the technicalities of teaching. Mm-hmm. And there are some technicalities of teaching. But I hope those initial teacher education students never forget why they came into teaching. They came in for one reason, to have an impact on kids. And that's what my work says. That's your job, to have an impact on kids. It's not to cover a curriculum to get high test scores. It's to have an impact. And one of the criticisms of my work, and I'm one of the first to say it, is I have focused on achievement. There are many other things that kids go to school. Some of my kids went to school for sport. Some go for friendship. Some go for lots of other reasons. I'll take anything. And I look at multiple factors. Whilst achievement is my focus, I am the first to say there are other as critical factors of schooling. Like, here's one of them. Pieces I'm working on doing at the moment in the area with special education students. More than anything, they need to be taught how to transfer skills. Mm-hmm. We don't do that with most kids. We teach them knowledge and that's it. We don't teach them how to transfer. And it's kind of ironic and wonderful in a way that the ways in which we teach many of our students with special needs are the ways we should be teaching all students how to learn something here so you can transfer it into another situation. I think that's exciting.
You've just said that there was criticism of your work. I mean, you know, obviously it was so influential all over the world. People kind of tried to make their way through it and so on. Has there been a criticism that you found helpful or constructive?
There's a lot of, I think that's one of the privileges of my life, as I have the world's best critics. And like, there's quite a lot of criticism about the methodology, and it's like meta-analysis is a method. It's like all methods. Mm. You can do them well, you can do them poorly. There are lots of issues there, and yeah, there's a lot we can learn from that. You know, my basic argument is the data give me areas for action, but they don't tell me how to make judgments and what the why question is, and that's what I've been trying to deal with. Every now and then someone comes out with a different interpretation and I listen to that. And in many cases, I've adopted those interpretations because they've added to the ways of thinking. You know, I was brought up very much in the induction school where you have a theory which we've developed now, and then you're looking for evidence that you're wrong. And so I'm always looking for other alternative interpretations. Yes, there's a methodology side, and that's sometimes good, but most times it's kind of a little bit picky. And yeah, there's some issues there. But the more interesting one is the different interpretations. And I've worked with a large number of people around the world now on different interpretations, and I've been the beneficiary of that. So yes, mm-hmm. I'm a great fan of criticism.
It's so interesting that you say that, because I remember when I wasn't like professionally into education and learning, and I wasn't writing books yet. I remember the first discussions about your study, and it seemed so arbitrary. For example, there were people who said, well, see, it's all about the teacher. So I can just stand there and talk, and it's great. It's what Hattie says. Or classroom size doesn't matter. It's what Hattie says. And it's all, I would say, a kind of a misreading or a misinterpretation, because like for the, in the one case, the meta studies don't say, teachers have now to be, you know, to keep on instructing. You say it's, he or she is a change agent. And this is something totally different. And with the classroom size, the effect size is just not high if you don't change anything in your teaching, right? It's not that you've got a smaller number of students and suddenly everything changes. You have to change yourself. So what I would like to know is, are there any other myths that have emerged from misreadings that you find especially, well, maybe annoying?
Oh, yeah, but I have to be annoyed at myself, Bob, because it means that I haven't written it well enough. And like, yeah, the class size one drives me mad because it's the one that's the most misinterpreted. And you know, I spent quite a bit of time and published quite a bit of work on why class size, what's happening there. Because you're right, you know, it has a small effect, but the question is why? And as you said, we know why it's small. It doesn't have to be like that. It could have an effect. And the irony is my own son, who's been a teacher now for 12 years, he's never had a class less than 90. I'm not advocating 90 is the right number. I'm not. But what I'm saying is, it's, as you said, it's what you do with them. So that's one that drives me mad. Homework's another one that gets misinterpreted because the effect size in elementary school is zero. People say we should ban it. No, we should ask why it's so small and improve it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are ways we know how to improve the impact of homework. And part of that's my fault. In the early days, I said, if it's less than 0.4, don't worry about it. Well, I should have said, if it's less than 0.4, worry about it even more.
Okay.
To understand why. And the other one that you mentioned, teachers make the difference. No, it's the variability amongst teachers that makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I could keep going with others that, like one of the mistakes I made in the early days was I created a ranking of all the lists. Now, I don't regret it. It got attention, but it got misused more than anything else we did. And about 9 years ago, we dropped it. We've never used it since.
How so?
Well, because people were saying, let's look at all the things at the top. We do that. Let's look at all the things at the bottom. We'll not do that. And that was never my story. My story was, what are the common elements of those things at the top compared to those things at the bottom? Like, take success criteria. Yeah, they're up there, but they're not in the top 10. But they underlie a lot of what's in the top 10. Their feedback, its effect size is around about 0.6, 0.7. It's not in the top 10, but it's a very powerful underlying factor of the top 10. And so we've dropped that ranking, and I think that was a good move. But it made it harder because people then didn't have that little checklist where they could say, oh, that matters. One of the things that drives me crazy, Bob, is that as a new study comes out, then the effect size can change. That's what progress means. But some people get very upset. Oh, it's changed. Therefore, which was right, which was wrong? I won't be out of a job. My job is to keep explaining.
Yeah, it's like that, right? Sisyphus is a happy man, according to Camus. He knows what to do with the stone and the hill. You talked about people who kind of took the effect sizes and kind of made a checklist out of it, which means they wanted to put it into practice. But then there are also teachers who are not really interested in asking how can we improve and what effect size has this or that method. Why?
Well, all that comes to the teacher self-concept work is that teachers who think they walk into a classroom and think their job is to expose students to the curricula to get them to pass test scores, they almost have a push-pull notion of students. I'm going to push them, I'm going to pull them. Mm-hmm. Rick Luthers say, my job is to turn these students onto learning. And they're therefore looking at ways they could do that. And sometimes they think of doing that by creating interesting, authentic, real-world examples. I'm not a fan of that either. My argument is that I want teachers who walk into a room and say, my job here today is to evaluate the teacher impact. I want to see if I can actually improve my students. I know I can, and that's my mission. And those are the teachers that have the biggest effect, those who have that ways of thinking. And so it's hard work. It's a lot easier to sit back and say, hey, I taught it. The students didn't learn it. It's so much easier for me to do, we know that teachers talk in a lesson 90% of the time. I'm an academic. It's so much easier to talk 100% of the time. That's not good teaching. Like one of our recent books was on listening, which we think is one of the most underestimated, underrated skills in the learning cycle. As a teacher, I have to listen to you, Bob, to better teach you. And surely it's also a mark of respect when I not only listen to you, but I demonstrate that I've heard what you're saying. I may not have to agree with you, but I've heard what you're saying. Those are much harder skills than stand and deliver.
Yeah, and I would also add to that, that they don't just, you know, fall into place, because in order to listen to students, they have to say something. And in order to say something, they have to feel secure to actually ask questions and make statements, and not at the same time think they're being, graded for that and so on. But maybe just a little experience. I actually changed my teaching a lot. And what I did was really trying to make learning visible, which resulted in me talking a lot less. In 10th grade, for example, there was no homework at all, because I thought it's kind of strange that when I say something they should do and they do it at home, where the expert, which is in this case me, is not there, that doesn't make any sense. And then they come back, and only the ones who actually succeeded in doing the homework would, talk about it. And the others who, I don't know, for whatever reason couldn't do it, and so on and so on and so on. But and what I just wanted to say is, I thought that was quite difficult after years of doing it another way, to really try to put the learning into the center. Are there and I know that's a very difficult question, and you make masterclasses and so on, and people have to read books and so on. But what are the first little steps into becoming somebody who prioritizes learning talking, let's say?
Well, a really critical question. And yes, I get asked it a lot. So we spend a lot of time on this, and we do a lot of work in schools. And we start with the culture and climate of your classroom. And we can take a video of you. We can come and watch you. And we look at things and we ask students, is it safe in this class to fail?
Yeah.
Does the teacher care about how you learn? Does the teacher keep teaching you until you learn it? You've already hinted at some of the other ones. What percentage of time does teachers talk compared to student talk? One of the most easiest ones and most powerful ones is simply count the student questions. Like, we know that teachers on average ask between 150 to 200 questions a day. They require less than 3-word answers. When we ask from the classroom observation work, how many questions does a class ask? Not a student, a class ask about their work in the day they don't understand the answer to. So I'm ruling out, what page am I on? Can I go to the toilet? The answer's two. Two questions a day. It's that simple. Is this class where the students are asking questions? And you can see it. You can feel it. You don't even have to interview the students. Now, if you go a step further, we also know, and there's lots of apps that we use, one where we ask the students to stop, identify how you're feeling right now. Now, I'm sure you can guess, Bob, the most dominant feeling that kids have in classrooms is boredom. And boredom is the lack of challenge. How challenging is the work? So this is where we start. There's lots of ways to start, but this is a really good way to start. Is I'd come into your class, Bob, I'd take a video of you, I'd do a bit of analysis, we'd sit down, we'd look at the percentage of time questions. We'd look at the teacher talk time. We'd look at some of the artifacts of the kids' work. Is it all about the facts or is it about the facts plus the curiosity? And so that's where you start, because many teachers that don't have high impact are mini lecturers. They want to talk. They want kids to do activities, and they don't want to give its students any responsibility for the quality in those activities. I'll tell you if it's good enough, Bob. You wait and see. Well, that's not good teaching. So I think there are lots of ways you can start, but it does require a different mindset, a different way of thinking about what your job is. And your job is not to cover all those things. It's more than that. It's to have an impact on students. And, you know, some of the impact, as we were talking about before with adults, is to turn them onto your passion, is to have high expectations, is to give them more challenging. And the art of the science of teaching is knowing, Bob, what's challenging for you may be differently challenging for the next student. And that's the art of teaching.
I'm quite interested at the moment in boredom. I read the book The Disengaged Teen by Rebecca Winthrop, who categorizes students into four different modes, so to speak: the passengers, the achievers, the resistors, and the explorers. I found that quite interesting. And, you know, she doesn't say they have to be that way and they stay there for the rest of their lives. It can be phases and so on. But I think she and her co-author asked 70,000, I think it was US students, what their perspective on school is, and 50% were these passengers. You know, they are there. You know, they go there, and you know, what I find so challenging is that we know that motivation comes from autonomy, from having the possibility to choose what you want to engage in, and so on. So how can we do that in a school system that has these subjects, that have these schedules and these curriculums and so on? Would you argue that teachers who have a different mindset can still do it within this structure? Or should we really put into question some of the, you know, bigger structures that how schools work in the year 2025, still, one probably has to say.
The reason I keep going is that as I travel the world, I see so much excellence. I see these teachers in action here and now within the constraints of our current system. And I was in your country last week, and I'm looking forward to coming back in a couple of weeks. I saw some stunning teachers' examples. You could see and feel the passion. You could feel the learning. You could feel the curiosity. It was ever present. So you can do it within the current system. It's a lot easier not to. And so there's contingencies. It's like if you spent all your resources doing this kind of teaching, other teachers would see that as not necessarily a good thing. But I see it, and the students see it, as very powerful. So no, I think you can do it within the current structures and the current system. And I think we have to find ways to esteem that. Like I think, for instance, principals, one of their fundamental responsibilities is they are responsible for the climate and culture in every class and across the school. Mm. They are responsible for identifying those teachers that are the ones that we're talking about that have that high impact on students, and having the courage to form a coalition around them and inviting the others to come in. And if I had to put my finger on the biggest problem in schooling, it's the lack of courage. It's so much easier to stand back and let teachers do what they want to do in the name of autonomy. We have duties and responsibilities, and one of them is to turn kids on to learning. I would argue that probably 50% of teachers in Germany can do that now as a matter of course. Our job's to increase that.
You know, on the one hand, I totally agree. On the other hand, I always, like, I've been talking to so many teachers who say I would do things differently, but they would reflect on themselves. They would say I don't have the courage, because if I do it differently, there are parents who ask me why you do that way. There are colleagues who say please don't do it like that way. Otherwise the parents will ask us to do the same. And there's the bureaucracy, right? Who asks, why did you do it that way? And I know from my experience when I included AI in a class test, and they could actually work with it, there have been questions. So I always say, yeah, I know we need more courage, but I would love a system where you don't have to be brave to do the right thing.
Yes, but I want to push you a step further there. This is where school leadership becomes critical, because some schools you can be brave and do these things. Some schools you should be terrified to be brave, because the principals and school leadership don't welcome it. And so as a system, I'm looking at the nature of school principals, and I want to have school principals that have that courage, that can give me the evidence that their school is a safe place to not know, that there is a safe place to explore, both as a teacher and a student. And you know, we have those schools, we have those leaders, and that's what I would, having worked in government policy for many years, I think this is where we can make that difference to make it safe. Now, one of the problems, I think, as you said, was the parents and this press that we have in your country and mine for test scores, high achievement. Mm-hmm. It's killing us. Like, some of the best entrepreneurs that are going to come out in Germany are not necessarily in the high achieving schools. Some of our schools where the high achieving, those kids are cruising. They're not adding no value whatsoever. But we have this rhetoric, and it's fascinating that, you know, it's only a recent rhetoric. It's only in the last 20 years that governments have been responsible for high achievement. Before then, we were responsible for leadership, for citizenship, for being nice to each other, as well as finding the best ways that kids could exceed what they think their potential was. We've ruined that in the last 20 years with our narrowing about tests. And I think I'm hoping there will day comes where we can bring back other
valuable
kind of schooling.
I mean, I don't want to, you know, open all the doors to this, but it's kind of capitalism, isn't it? It's viewing schools as, I don't know, as places for students to I don't know, to get a job.
But Bob, I'm greedy. I want them all. I want
high achievement. Yeah, me too.
I want them to get a job.
But I don't want to end in this very negative way. So I'm going to ask one more question concerning what you just told me about the schools you were, where you could actually feel the passion and, you know, the learning and the teaching. What did they do differently? What was it? I mean, probably there are so many factors. I get it. But is there something like, could you paint a picture of what this school or these schools do differently that actually leads to this whole atmosphere of, yeah, great teaching?
Look, there is a common denominator, and that is when you walk into the staff room, you hear the teachers talking about their impact. You hear them supporting each other. You don't see a school of independent contractors. You see a school of people who are working together. They don't mention my students. They say our students. They don't mention my classroom. They talk about our classroom. That collective notion is incredibly powerful in those schools. What they're doing is welcome. They're supporting each other. They can walk into anyone's classroom, not ever to watch a teacher teach, but to help teachers see the impact they're having on students. And that's not a strange thing in those schools. So it comes down again, I think, to leadership, where that collective responsibility is there. It's very hard to do it, but it's possible to do it by yourself in a school where this is not welcomed. But it's hard work. And it should be hard work and good work. But some teachers, some other schools don't see it as good work. But What we do in our work and all the visible learning work is we work with the leadership team. We work on saying that everybody's responsible for everybody in the school. You start in the staff room. If you get that right, it filters right down to the classroom. It can be done.
At the very end, I always ask my guests to have like some kind of recommendation for further reading and so on. I would probably recommend Klaus Zierer's translation of your visible learning. In German, it's called Hetty für gestresste Lehrer, Hetty for stressed teachers. And that basically the title is like that because it's a little shorter and you can, you know, you don't have to have a free week to actually read it. But is there anything that you find quite interesting at the moment for like as a further reading or podcast or whatever?
The other one that has just been translated into German is the Illustrated Guide to Visible Learning.
Oh, yeah.
So that's another one. But I go back to 1956. There was a book back then that I think was one of the best books ever written. It had the best title, and it was called Teaching as a Subversive Activity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really good idea and a good concept. But I also think that you mentioned that the person on Boredom before, Dan Willingham's book on why students don't like school is to me a classic. And I'd be recommending that as a good read too, because he's got some really good answers on there.
Thanks a lot. Today I talked to John Hattie, the education researcher who became famous for his meta study on how learning can be made visible. Thanks for being here, John.
Thank you, Bob. I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks in Germany.
Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Ich hoffe, die Folge hat euch gefallen. Falls ihr Fragen oder Anregungen habt, könnt ihr ab jetzt auch eine Mail schreiben an dieschulebrennt, alles klein und zusammen, @auf-die-ohren.com. Die Schule brennt ist eine Produktion von Auf die Ohren, exklusiv für die ARD. Redaktionelle Leitung und Schnitt Katharina Kern. Audiodesign und Postproduktion Milan Fey.